Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 23rd of December, these are our main stories. The US Supreme Court refuses to fast-track a decision on whether Donald Trump can be tried for federal crimes. The UN Security Council approves a watered-down resolution on aid to Gaza without a call for a suspension of hostilities. A plane carrying more than 300 Indian nationals bound for Nicaragua has been grounded in France over suspected human trafficking. Also in this podcast...
Most popular baubles this year are Ukrainian Defender, the Heart of Ukraine, and Kherson Watermelon. We made this one when our troops liberated Kherson.
We hear how Ukrainians are preparing for Christmas after switching from the Russian to the Western festive calendar. The US Supreme Court has declined, for now, to decide whether former President Donald Trump has immunity from prosecution for allegedly trying to overturn the 2020 election. Mr. Trump's efforts to delay his trial appear successful, as the case must now work its way through the appeals process. Special Counsel Jack Smith had asked the court to take up the case in an expedited manner. I heard more from Gary O'Donoghue, our Washington correspondent.
The special counsel, Jack Smith, who's been tasked with taking this indictment to trial against Donald Trump, he was asking the Supreme Court, saying, look, we need to settle this question before even a trial can go ahead. Otherwise, there's no point having a trial. You know, can the president be tried for things he did while he was president? And he wanted to get that decision made quickly because eventually it would bubble up to the Supreme Court. And he wanted to bypass one stage of that, which is the appeals court. And the Supreme Court has said no. They haven't given any reasons. They haven't said why. We don't know which way each of them voted, the nine justices. But it does mean that there will now be a delay because this trial was due to start in March. But it does mean there's going to be an extra stage where the appeals court hears it before the Supreme Court will ultimately have to make a decision.
So this could well not happen until after the presidential election.
This could be a delay of 2 months, some say, 3 months, others say. And bear in mind, Donald Trump's strategy, legal strategy, is one of delay. Because, of course, there is the very real possibility that even if he were convicted of federal crimes, if he then gets elected president, there's a very real possibility he could pardon himself, completely untested legally. But it's something that's one of those hot topic debating issues around the election. So he hopes all this goes away until after the election, in which case, any kind of trial would have to wait another 4 years while he was still president. But if not, he wants it to go as close as possible to the election and become a part of the political debate.
And presumably his political opponents are going to be looking at the makeup of the US Supreme Court.
Well, we know that there's a conservative majority on that court, 6-3. Three of those were appointed by Donald Trump. It's meant to make an unbiased judgment on the basis of the constitutional arguments, and that's what it'll be asked to do. But there is no question that the complexion of the court does matter when it comes to deciding not just the big sort of social issues of the day, as we've seen with things like abortion rights and LGBTQ rights, etc., but also these political moments as well. This court doesn't always go his way. Let's be clear about that. But I think he feels that he will stand a good chance in front of them.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. After days of intense negotiations, postponements and amendments, a resolution intended to boost aid into Gaza has finally been passed by the UN Security Council in New York. Supported by the United States, the resolution does not answer global calls for a ceasefire. Instead, it asks for what has been described as urgent steps to allow desperately needed humanitarian relief into the Palestinian territory. Ambassador Lana Zaki Nusseibeh is the representative of the United Arab Emirates, which proposed the resolution. She said they had visited Rafah in Gaza and saw the hell unleashed there following the Hamas attacks on Israel.
Half of the people of Gaza are now starving. The UN has reported that the proportion of people hungry in Gaza is higher than any country in any conflict in the last 20 years. Let's be clear. In the coming period, unless we take drastic action, there will be famine in Gaza. The purpose of this text is very simple. It responds with action to the dire humanitarian situation on the ground for the Palestinian people, while protecting those who are trying to deliver life-saving aid.
The US vetoed the last vote on the 8th of December. Today, 13 countries voted in favour, with Russia and the United States abstaining. Israel's assault on Gaza by air and with soldiers on the ground was in response to the unprecedented attack by Hamas in southern Israel on October the 7th, in which 1,200 people were killed and some 250 others were taken hostage. Around 130 are still being held. Barbara Plett-Usher, our US correspondent, has been giving me her assessment of the significance of the resolution.
On the one hand, the resolution doesn't have any teeth. The one thing that would have given it teeth was a call for a cessation of hostilities in order for the aid to be delivered. And that was taken out of the draft because the U.S. would not support that. Because of that, some of the sponsors, Jordan and Algeria, withdrew their names. They felt it wouldn't have any impact. On the other hand, given the dynamics on the ground, given that there was no way that the U.S. would support a ceasefire, given that the U.N. is saying that Gazans are in danger of starvation, I think there was a strong feeling on the council to try to do what they could to push diplomatically, at least, to get more aid into Gaza. And so the feeling there is that the effectiveness of what has happened will be judged by, you know, the coming weeks. How much can they actually increase and accelerate the aid into Gaza?
As you say, no specific call for a cessation of hostilities, but there is this call for creating the conditions for a cessation of hostilities. What does that mean?
Well, we don't know exactly. It wasn't spelled out at all. I think it's probably deliberately vague because of the objections of the Americans and the Israelis to a call for a ceasefire. They have supported a ceasefire if it's related to a specific thing, like getting hostages out of Gaza, or like a humanitarian pause for a brief period. But they don't want in any way to have an end of hostilities that would prevent Israel from trying to destroy the military capability of Hamas. But there's strong pressure, as we all know, from much of the rest of the United Nations to stop the hostilities, to have a ceasefire. And so this is as close as they were able to get. Some council members did note it's the first time those words have actually appeared in a resolution, cessation of hostilities. So there is that.
Barbara, can I play you this clip? It's Palestine's ambassador to the UN, Riyad Mansour.
This resolution is a step in the right direction. It must be implemented and must be accompanied by massive pressure for an immediate ceasefire. I repeat, immediate ceasefire. There is no way to stop the war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide underway, but an immediate ceasefire.
Barbara, the Israeli ambassador has also been speaking. What did he have to say?
He was quite critical. He said that the UN's focusing only on aid mechanisms to Gaza was unnecessary. It was disconnected from reality. He claimed that Israel is already allowing aid deliveries in at the required scale and that the UN should focus more on the humanitarian crisis of the hostages. And the resolution does mention hostages. Now, I should add that one of the main sticking points in these long negotiations this week was over whether the UN could set up a mechanism to monitor aid going into Gaza, to speed up the amount of aid getting into the strip, because right now trucks have to go into Israel to get inspected by the Israelis. But the Israelis objected because they didn't want to be taken out of the screening cycle, and the Americans supported them on that. And what the Israeli ambassador said, he thanked the U.S. for what he said was maintaining Israel's security authority to inspect aid.
Barbara Plett-Usher. And Hamas is reported to have said that it considers the resolution to be an insufficient step in meeting Gaza's requirements. On Friday, a plane carrying more than 300 Indian nationals was grounded in northeastern France after it stopped for refueling. The Airbus A340 had taken off from the United Arab Emirates and was heading for Nicaragua. French authorities said the passengers were likely to be victims of human trafficking. But as Julian Marshall has been hearing from Manuel Orozco of the Inter-American Dialogue, a US-based think tank that focuses on Latin America and the Caribbean, it may not be that simple.
Well, there has been some argument about possible human trafficking, but most likely it's simply people taking advantage of using Nicaragua as a port of entry to come to the United States by land. And it's not a new phenomenon. It's been going on for several months from different nationalities. The one most known was Haitians going from Port-au-Prince on charter flights to Managua. But also there was also charter flights from Providenciales into Managua from different nationalities, including Indians and people of the African continent.
So you're saying that these people are heading to the United States. Why does Nicaragua allow them into the country?
The Nicaraguan government has an ideological controversy with the United States. It despises the United States as an enemy country, and it has weaponized migration as a way to send migrants into the border and increase the problem of the current migration crisis that's going on. So far, since early this year, at least 100,000 passengers have arrived on charter flights through Managua, coming to the United States border with Mexico. So companies have been negotiating with the Nicaraguan governments to perform these charter flights on a regular basis.
I mean, you say that these are not victims of human trafficking, that, you know, they're obviously know what they're doing, going to Nicaragua en route for the United States. But there must be some organization behind this.
There is definitely a network of service provision for special transportation into Managua. So in some way, you can consider it a form of human trafficking, but people are taking the opportunity to do that. But in the case of Indians, there was evidence that there were direct flights coming from Europe, from Spain in particular, into San Salvador for over the past 6 months. So there is a switch into routes, perhaps because Nicaragua offered a better opportunity to the companies and to the passengers that were part of the flying.
Manuel Orozco of the Inter-American Dialogue think tank. Japan has announced that it will send Patriot air defence missiles to the United States after relaxing rules on defence exports. Japan's pacifist constitution has until now precluded Tokyo's small defence industry selling equipment abroad. The government is trying to boost its military in the face of an assertive China. Will Leonardo from our news desk has more.
This is a big move for Japan, which has had up to now a relatively small defence industry, kind of mostly with domestic focus. Remember, Japan has a pacifist constitution put in place after its defeat in the Second World War. Until 10 years ago, it couldn't export any defence products. It was changed then to be able to export parts, and now they can export full, fully produced products back to countries that hold the original patent of the product. So in this case, we're talking about US patented Patriot air defence missiles. They're going to be sent, according to the Foreign Ministry of Japan, to the US. The US, of course, has been sending its stocks of the Patriot air defence missiles to Ukraine to help in the war against Russia. And this, of course, has been welcomed by the US. The US reaction has been swift and positive. The ambassador to Japan, Rahm Emanuel, called it historic. The Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor, has said it will contribute to the security of Japan and the stability of the Indo-Pacific region as well. And that's also the context of this. It's not just the war in Ukraine. Japan's been playing catch-up to various security threats in the region, especially from a more assertive China, and it wants to boost its own defence industry, which, as I said, has been relatively small until now. On the same day that this rule change was announced, and it was announced that these Patriot missiles were going to be shipped to the US, the Japanese government approved a record defence budget for next year of $56 billion. That's 16% increase compared to last year. And it shows that while Japan remains nominally a pacifist country, in practice it's being forced to stretch that definition because of what it considers to be the growing insecurity in the region that it sits in.
Will Leonardo. Ukraine is fighting Russia for a second festive season, but for the first time in more than a century, Christmas will be celebrated on December the 25th. In a snub to Moscow, the country's main Christian Orthodox Church has switched from the Russian holiday of January the 7th. Our correspondent in Kyiv, James Waterhouse, has been asking Ukrainians, young and old, how they are preparing for Christmas this year.
Thankfully for these children, Christmas comes in war or peace. At this decoration shop in the outskirts of Kyiv, they can paint their own baubles. The shape of them reflects the times they are growing up in.
So what's your most popular ball?
Most popular baubles this year are Ukrainian Defender, the Heart of Ukraine, and Kherson Watermelon. We made this one when our troops liberated Kherson last year.
Those patriotic decorations are made here, at this old factory in the town of Kladievo-Tarasovo, not far from Ukraine's capital.
For me, Christmas is the best holiday of the year. But now there is the war. We used to have many visitors, many excursions. It was very interesting. Now it stopped.
Production halted when this area was occupied by the Russians for a month early in the invasion. It's since resumed, but nowhere near the level it did. Five women are hand-painting baubles, and you are drawn to the theme, male and female soldiers, the Ukrainian trident. Tamila is painting a flag on a bauble of a Ukrainian tractor. I think that everyone will take a look at such a bauble and will hope for the victory of our country sooner, she says. Her colleague Henya admits the war has changed their life and work.
It's not easy to work, but you want to do your job because people always remain people and a holiday is always a holiday.
Ukraine's culture is being strengthened by Russia's aggression. It's trying to distance itself any way it can, and few places have experienced that aggression more than Bucha, this commuter town an hour or so from Kyiv. We're outside the Church of St. Andrew. Its golden domes are glistening in the winter sunlight. And to my right, there is a silver memorial where there was a makeshift mass grave for the civilians who were gunned down by Russian forces as they tried to advance on Ukraine's capital. In the silent, candle-lit crypt, we meet Father Andriy.
The fact is that we've now changed the calendar and celebrate Christmas and other holidays with Europe. And it's not shifting away from Russia. It is us returning back to Europe, where we belong.
Could you ever forgive Russia?
God forgives a sinner, but not all the sinners, only those who repent. So I think it's too early to talk about forgiveness.
For Ukraine, any sign of Russian repentance would have to be accompanied with an ending of its invasion. There is still zero sign of that happening.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv. And still to come in this podcast. How orangutans communicate may show us the evolutionary path to human language. Next to Niger. Where the last French troops have flown from the West African country after a decade of working alongside local forces to tackle an Islamist insurgency. Army officers who seized power in July made the French departure one of their key demands. France is also shutting its embassy, which was attacked by thousands of protesters in the wake of the coup. Niger's new rulers have been accused of asking for support from the Wagner Russian mercenary group to help them maintain order. Here's our regional correspondent, Thomas Nardi.
Following the military coup in July, which ousted President Mohamed Bazoum, the junta had been whipping up anti-French sentiments in that country. And as the French troops left, a lot of people, some residents in Niamey, were very excited about this. Certainly, it will have dire security implications for Niger and the Sahel region. The French forces supported the Nigerian army, training them, and then also helping them with combat missions and intelligence sharing. They also provided support to civilians fleeing jihadi attacks in the Sahel region. Now that they are gone, there's going to be a security void. We do know that the Americans are there. The U.S. has its second largest military base in Africa, in Niger. But their operations have been severely limited because of the military coup. Now, what we have seen is an increase in attacks by the Islamist groups in that region. And it remains to be seen whether the recently formed alliance between Niger, Burkina Faso and Mali with Wagner's involvement will be able to resolve the situation. France deployed its troops to Niger to play a supportive role, and they did that effectively. But, of course, expectations were very high, and then they couldn't manage to meet those expectations. So the military leaders that came into power decided to capitalize on that and then whip up anti-French sentiments to get them out of the region.
Thomas Nardi. Now, how do you get rid of space junk? It's a growing problem with thousands of defunct satellites orbiting the Earth, posing some pretty obvious dangers. Early on Friday, NASA released images of the International Space Station getting rid of its waste material by deliberately sending a small spacecraft on a re-entry path where it's incinerated in the Earth's atmosphere. So, is this the best way of getting rid of around 25,000 bits of space junk that NASA estimates are out there? Matthew Amrolawala heard more from the UK Space Agency's Professor Malcolm MacDonald.
It's a very reliable way to do it. And it's something that, you know, when we only had a few spacecraft, we had to get rid of them, we had to get them out of orbit. This is a safe and reliable way. But what's changed over the last few years is we're now moving from a time where we had, you know, a few hundred satellites in orbit to launching thousands of satellites per year. And what that means is that in 5, 6, 7 years, we're going to have thousands and thousands of satellites per year burning up in the atmosphere. Now, we already see things in the atmosphere from launch vehicles. We already see traces of small elements of satellites that have burned up in the past. So there is a suggestion that it's there. And ultimately, these particles, they might be small, they might be high up in the atmosphere, but they will make their way down through the atmosphere. And, well, again, we don't really know yet what effect they will have, whether they could enter, you know, the food chain or anything else. It's all up for debate. It's all up for scientific study, but something that we need to be thinking about.
You talk about the large chunks, even the small fragments of space junk. It's worth just describing to our viewers the dangers, because even tiny, tiny pieces going at the velocity they go at when they're in space pose huge dangers both to the International Space Station and actually astronauts if they potentially were hit by even a very small fragment on a spacewalk.
Really, it's the very small things that are actually the danger to other satellites. You know, but like anything, if you've got a big satellite, it's quite easy to see it. It's quite easy to know where it is and determine where it's going. But when you get really small things, you know, less than a centimetre, a few millimetres in size, they're going just as quick. You know, they're travelling like a really fast bullet. They hit your satellite, they'll just go straight through that satellite. And, you know, they might just damage it. They might chip a window on a space station, or they might hit something really vital and just destroy that spacecraft. And that's one of the real concerns that we've got, that, you know, a relatively small particle like that hits a big satellite. That big satellite is a reservoir of lots of small bits. And that then triggers some sort of cascade effect that takes out other satellites. So again, that's why we're seeing this exponential growth in the number of satellites. There's an increased risk of something going wrong just because we've not really taken the time to think about it. We've not got the regulation in place. The technology is running ahead of that. There's all sorts of geopolitical things going on as well about strategic advantage of being in space that's holding back the regulation. So there's a whole world of things coming together to make it really difficult to understand and control what we do and make sure that we have a sustainable environment.
Professor Malcolm MacDonald from the UK Space Agency. Now, to a piece of research in which scientists have been trying to work out whether human language evolved when our ancestors moved from living in trees to living in Africa's open grasslands, when the forests turned to savanna millions of years ago as a result of climate change. And they've been testing the theory using these sounds from orangutans. Charlotte Gannon's from the University of Warwick. She led the research. James Menendez asked her to explain what those sounds meant.
You listened there to a kiss squeak and a grunt. So the first part of it was the kiss squeak, the part that we refer to as a proto-consonant, And the grump is the second part. That's what we call a proto-vowel. They're often made by the orangutans in combination, a bit like an alarm call.
What did you then do as part of your research with those sounds?
Those sounds were originally recorded in Borneo and Sumatra from various different populations. They were then played across the savannah in South Africa. We were really interested in looking at how the shift from the dense forests to open landscapes that our early ancestors will have gone through, what role that played in language. So we were really interested to see how far these calls would travel.
And how far did they travel? And did the consonants travel further than the vowel sounds?
All the way up to 400 metres. A good majority, about 80% of the consonant-based calls were still audible, whereas only about 20% of those vowel-like calls remained audible.
And were you surprised by that? Because one might think that the vowel sounds, especially a long vowel sound, that would sustain for longer and therefore be heard more easily from a distance.
We actually expected the vowel-like calls to travel further, because they're lower frequency and the kiss-squeaks are higher frequency. We actually found the reverse in this situation.
Just explain a little bit more about what that tells us about human evolution or the evolution of our ancestors anyway.
And obviously, orangutans, they're not a direct ancestor of us. We're more looking at them as a bit of a parallel to sort of understand a bit more about what happened to our language. Maybe this landscape change did have an effect. And this is why we've ended up merging with such a consonant-heavy base language.
And am I right in thinking that humans are unique in that sense?
We're the only species to have not only this language capacity, but it's so rich. We have this massive, limitless base of language. We look all around the world and we just have so many different variations, but it's still only unique to just us humans.
And so what next with this research? I mean, how will you sort of firm it up further? Or are we always going to be dealing in the realms of speculation to some extent, do you think?
Well, obviously, the issue with language is it doesn't fossilise. So it's one of those ones where we do have to kind of always have a bit of a theory-based approach to it. And it's why great apes are valuable to our story of language.
Charlotte Gannon from Warwick University. The operator of a train used in the Harry Potter films is considering its future after it lost a court battle over safety. As Olivia Otaba reports, fans visit Scotland for the ride of a lifetime.
Fans have been able to ride the same train as the Boy Wizard by stepping onto the locomotive and carriages used in the films. The Jacobite steam train in Scotland rides between Fort William to Mallaig twice a day from March to October, and is widely regarded as one of the most scenic rail journeys in the world. However, West Coast Railways, the company which operates the journey, has just lost a high court battle to a rail regulator over door safety. The company took legal action against the Office of Rail and Road, the ORR, after it refused to grant an exemption to a ban on the use of hinged doors without a central locking system. West Coast Railways claims that implementing the measures to 1950s slam door carriages would cost up to $9 million. Around 100,000 journeys are made on the line each year, but despite this, a judge dismissed the case, citing instances where a lack of central locking had compromised passenger and door safety. The ORR stressed that it had no intention of putting heritage train operators out of business, but expected companies to meet minimum safety standards. West Coast Railways said that safety was its top priority and that it would consider its options. Perhaps a little Harry Potter magic will keep the service running.
Olivia Otaba reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Annie Smith and the producer was Carl Josephs. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.